Tom Clyde has stories, and this multi-generational Utahn is not afraid to tell them. Whether it's in his award-winning column called More Dogs on Maine in the Park Record, or his 25 years as a writer and MC with the Follies, he's seen it all, and his perspective on the growth, the philanthropy, and the town in general is uniquely his own. I caught up with him during his final run with the Follies. He decided 25 years was long enough for that role, and he will be missed. But he's not going anywhere. He is a treasure and beloved member of this community. Here is my conversation with the one and only Tom Clyde. I'm here with Tom Clyde, the master of ceremonies, Tom Clyde, and I'm so happy you're here.
Nice to be here. It's a true rumor. 25 years is enough. I need to back out and move on for a number of reasons, but I think it's good for the show, too, to get a fresh voice on it.
Do you have a background in the arts, theater?
No, absolutely none. I was a lawyer.
You're a lawyer.
I was an English major in college. It's funny how life takes serendipitous turns. Mm-hmm. I was city attorney here in Park City from 1980 to 85. The town doubled in population, basically went broke in the 85 economic downturn, and it just crushed me. I was done. Mm. So I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And Jan Wilking, who owned the Park Record at the time, and Terry Orr, who was the editor, offered me a $20 a week spot if I'd do a column. Okay, sounds fun.
So I asked if he would write a column for the paper when he left the city.
That's Terry Orr, former editor of the Park Record and longtime friend of Tom Clyde.
And he felt then that maybe it would be okay since he wasn't representing the city anymore. And he said, I'm not going to tell, like, city secrets. No, but you know so much that the rest of us don't know, and you have your style about you, so maybe there's a way to combine those. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he did beautifully and won awards, newspaper awards for his column.
And that was nearly 40 years ago now.
Oh, wow. Have you gotten a raise?
I have. It is still not something that one can live on, but it was never intended to be. It's just purely for fun.
Yeah.
I joke about Jan paying me $20 a week. I would, you know, happily pay the paper what they pay me for the privilege of doing it.
How do you describe what you write about? Writing about how it used to be or how you wish it was? And how'd you come up with the name, More Dogs on Main Street?
No Dogs on Main Street was the campaign slogan for a guy that was running for mayor when I first came up here working. And his platform was, I mean, there was a big push to sort of gentrify the town.
And this was when? The
late 70s, early 80s.
Okay.
And it was pretty rough. There were junk cars everywhere, and it was sometimes hard to tell an abandoned house from one that people were living in. And one of my first assignments as city attorney was to get an ordinance that would allow us to tow all the junk cars. And I think we pulled probably 75 or 80 junk cars out of Old Town that mm-hmm. had just been pushed off the downhill side of Woodside Avenue onto a vacant lot.
No way.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Park City in the late 70s, early 80s really was the Wild West. And we were making up a town as we went along. It had, of course, been here. It had been a successful silver mining town. But the mines were closing down when I moved here in 79. In fact, I was here when the last mine closed.
It had a lot of charm, but it was not thriving. So there's a big push to clean it up and gentrify it and make it beautiful. And O.D. McGee's campaign when he ran for mayor was, there's nothing wrong with Park City that couldn't be cured with more dogs on Main Street. Literally, to get into the post office, you just kind of had to fight the dogs off to get through. And if you were looking for somebody pre-cell phone, you could go up and down Main Street and see which bar his dog was parked in front of. Sick. And when you moved to town, you were issued a Sweet Alley retriever.
Well, it sounds like you've been here for quite a long time. Tell me about the history of you and your family.
My dad's family was among the first settlers in Heber. And they were in the sheep business and grazed sheep all over. Their winter range was out in Tooele County. Right up till World War II, they would herd sheep down Parley's Canyon, that mm-hmm. at that point was a two-lane road, and down 21st South through Sugar House and out to Tooele County.
Wow. Amazing.
My grandfather went sort of spectacularly bankrupt during the Depression, and my dad watched all that happen and the legal maneuvering and said, I'm going to law school. So my dad practiced law in Salt Lake, and I grew up kind of splitting my time between there and the ranch the family later bought out in Woodland.
And is it a working ranch?
It's an awkward size. It's too big for a hobby and too small for a business.
So where does that leave you?
Puzzled. They call it an unbalanced operation. I don't have winter range. I don't have forest permits.
You know, he drives in. I mean, he got a ranch out there.
That's Miles Raidman, the founder of the Park City Leadership Program, former city's public affairs manager, and also longtime friend of Mr. Clyde.
You know, and I remember when they were paving the road, the Wolf Creek Pass. He wrote a column that in Time magazine about the road to nowhere.
Okay.
And here they're paving this road from Summit County over to Tabiona or someplace. And he lives right at the beginning of where they started to pave it. So he wrote this column. But he's always had that wonderful perspective of being rural.
It's spectacular. It's tucked away in the Uintas. You can feel the generations there. You can feel the great care and the stewardship that that family has, that's been so important to that family mm-hmm. for generations.
Yeah. What do? You drive tractors? Are you like that kind of guy?
Or? Yeah.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Okay. You're like the real deal.
No, it's very hands-on. 12 miles of barbed wire fence we're maintaining.
I was lucky enough to get an invitation from Tom to come and see his beautifully maintained historical landmark ranch. And I also got to meet his dog. Hi, Tom. Oh, my gosh. You're right by the river. That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Kind of a pathetic stream this year, but it is what it is. About a quarter of what it should be. Yeah, normally you can hear boulders crashing. Keeps you up at night.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. I don't know what you want to really get to get the sense of the farm, but why don't we get in the truck and I'll just drive you around a little
okay,
bit.
Okay, that'd be awesome.
See, we've got
And what's in there, cattle? Or?
Cattle, yeah. Okay. You know, very complicated irrigation systems. We put in a center pivot. I'd never known anything about them before and have now become a pretty decent pivot technician.
Don't even know what that is. Is that the thing that waters the...
That's the thing when you fly over, you see the round circles.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a magical little place. When I was a kid, what's now the Biscuit Company was the general store.
Oh, wow.
And it would have been possible to go in there buck naked and starving and walk out fully dressed, a week's worth of groceries, furniture for your house on order, and then you could fill up your car with gas while you were there.
Yeah. What did you do after city attorney? Did you retire from that job and continue to practice law whilst becoming a stage star?
Practiced on my own here in town for quite a while. Yeah, I was doing real estate work. I'd look around at all the development that I find so appalling, and there's a heck of a lot of it that has my fingerprints all over it. So
I always said, Tom has a way of deflating every balloon and being right about it and doing it with a sense of humor and so forth. So you have to kind of appreciate him. I've been on the wrong side of some of the things that he did because I worked for the city for almost 40 years. But he and I just love the guy. I think he's right on 90% of the issues, which is 50% more than I'm right. And he has that great perspective because he's a native Utahn with long, deep roots in Utah. And so he has that perspective of longtime local family and yet being part of this community here.
I mean, I look at Park City and I still absolutely love it. It's a fascinating community. My earliest memories of it were literally as like a five-year-old. Dad and I would drive up on Saturday. We'd have pizza at Red Banjo, which was pizza that long ago was a new and daring thing. And, you know, mother was not about to have that in the house.
Oh, really?
And then we'd go over to Heber and visit Grandma, and then we'd go up to the ranch for a while. And, you know, so we just sort of made that circuit. And I was fascinated by it because it was so different from other Utah towns.
Was it true that it was kind of seen as like where the heathens live?
Oh.
It was like, well, that's where you go if you're going to, you know, get into some trouble.
Into the 70s, Salt Lake banks would not lend money up here.
Wow.
And when Edgar Stern bought the Park City Resort in, I believe, 71 or 72, he couldn't get the professionals that he needed to come up here. He couldn't get civil engineers. They said, I'm not working in Park City. He couldn't get architects. The business community in Salt Lake would have nothing to do with it. It was gambling and prostitution and demon rum, and they were not, it just wasn't happening. So Edgar brought in this huge influx of young professionals.
Those people came in, and the ski resort owned most of the buildings that were standing in decent shape on Main Street and owned a bunch of land on the other side of town. They didn't want to be involved in any business except the ski business. So they would go around and say to the bartender at the bar, do you like being a bartender? And if he said yes, would you like to buy this building? And they would say, well, we can't afford it. And the Park City Resort would say, well, do you have $5,000? And he would say, yes. Okay, well, then you can have the building.
This is my favorite part about Park City. He brought in all the greater Park City company employees who were everything he needed, from architects, engineers, interior designers. He brought them all in and put them on the payroll, and then things didn't work out, and one day they are all unemployed. They kind of overbuilt. They had a bad snow year, too many condos, and it just all kind of collapsed. And then the greater Park City people who were here all said, well, this is really kind of a great deal, and I don't want to move on. And they were people with a lot of talent, but probably not folks who are going to be comfortable in a cubicle farm in Salt Lake. And they said, well, we got to figure out how to stay here. And so there was a whole generation of Park City businesses that grew out of that. And they just said, well, okay, I'll keep doing the same job. And today I'm Jack Johnson Engineering or Alliance Engineering or Ted War Architecture.
Mm-hmm.
It was an amazing experience. I mean, I compare it, that whole period from like the early 70s to about 1990. That was like moving out onto the prairie in the 1880s and building a town from scratch. And it was so small. It was such a tiny place in terms of 300 or 400 people. They'd turn up everywhere. They were involved in everything. The Tina Lewises, the Bob Wells, a lot of the women who had moved here, Greater Park City influx, had careers, busily working at it. Things happen. They get married. And suddenly they're having kids. And it's like, I don't want to quit working. I don't have grandma here to leave my kid with. And there's no daycare. So you get Jana Cole and Sid Reed and a whole bunch of others in that period who saw a need for daycare and put together there were a whole variety of nonprofit co-op daycare things that just filled those needs. And every time somebody would see a need in town, pretty quick, somebody would step up and fill it. And most of these things operated off somebody's kitchen table. And then by the mid-80s, they began to get big enough that banks wanted things like a taxpayer ID number on the checking account. And there was about a two-year period where I think I incorporated 20 nonprofits. I can't remember who the first, I guess the first one was actually the museum. Or it could have been even Friends of the Animals. Mountain Trails was one that is a big success.
And oh, wow.
Tom was someone that I went to for advice. And I would say I'm trying to write this piece about. I don't understand quite how we got here. Every time I was writing a heavy editorial, I felt like I needed a little bit of Tom's wisdom, but also knowledge, experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure he knows how much that meant to me, that he never blew me off and said, do your own homework, you know, or something else. But he would say, you know, there was a time in the 70s where this happened, which is why this happened in the 80s, which became the 90s, you know.
But that whole volunteer movement seems really unique to Park City. I mean, it happens elsewhere, but not on the scale that it happened here. And you look at that and you think, wow, the talent that is donated to making stuff happen. Despite all the physical change in town and the growth and the fact that you kind of can't tell where Summit Park ends and Heber begins, that volunteer spirit of making things happen is what's so wonderful here.
Tom, the other day at Rotary, he said, you know, it was time for me to retire because a lot of people don't have the context of my jokes anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So when people say Park City is a special place, yeah, to those of us who help make it, it's a special place. For those who are here now making it, it'll be a special place for them. But it's important that we keep telling those stories, and Tom is a consummate storyteller.
The 25 years at the Follies has been extremely satisfying, and that's partly why I decided I needed to move on, is that instead of writing to an insider group that was maybe 5,000 to 7,000 people, maybe 10 at the outside, suddenly it's a huge community. Shared experience isn't as consistent or as shared as it used to be. It used to be there were holes in the screen at the Egyptian Theater where you could stand behind and peek through a little pinhole and see who the audience was as the house filled up.
Uh-huh.
And I used to know probably 75 or 80% of the people there. And now I get out there and I probably don't know 10% of the audience anymore. Yeah, it's a different world.
Yeah.
And I'm probably hopelessly mired back in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was cheap to live here. You could buy a house for $700. And people stayed, and they loved it, and they protected it, and we're all the beneficiaries of that.
He's part of the growth, part of the changes, lamented the changes, made fun of the changes. So I don't know if there's one story. I think his whole life is the story.
Tom's take is just Tom's take on things. He just sees the world through this great, quirky lens, or as anyone who reads his stuff or even spends 10 minutes with him knows.
This winter, riding up from the East Village side and talking to the guy on the chair, he looks at me and he says, "Oh, I know you. You're that Follies guy, aren't you?" And I said, yeah, that's me. He says, "Oh, I like the show." And then we ride along for a little while, and then he looks at me and says, "That picture of you in the paper must be ancient." And my first impulse was to push him out of the chair. He was right. It was a 20-year-old picture. Has since been upgraded.
And there you have it. Case in point, Tom Clyde's amazing sense of humor. What better way to end this story than on that? This is Andrea Buchanan with KPCW's Community Campfire.